All right. Welcome to Inside Independent Publishing. My name is Christopher Locke, and I'm the IBPA member liaison. And real quick, before we get started, there's going to be a bonus offer ad that's going to play during this episode, and that is for a 15% discount, 15% to go to IBPA Publishing University. We are excited for you to come, so watch the whole episode and you will see that ad. Okay, so this is a really important topic today, so I just want to jump right in. We're going to discuss how independent publishers can be supportive of diversity, equity, and inclusion, also known as DEI, and that includes being anti-racist. And as our incredible guest today, we have the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer, April Powers. Hello.
Hi, Chris. Great to see you. Great to see everyone out there in, is it YouTube land?
So we have, this will be audio and video. So people watching this are seeing us right now, but some people will just hear us. So hopefully our voices sound awesome.
Okay. And I have to add a couple more letters to that already unwieldy acronym.
Yeah.
I would add to DEI, I would do DEIBCA, which adds diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, civility, and anti-racism. And to the SCBWI, though I can't, I would love to also add translators because we do support all the translators of children's works
right
all over the world. So
already amazing information. We're right from the get-go.
I can't help myself.
No, that's good. That's what I want. And I also want to acknowledge right at the top. So for people listening, I just want to say I'm white, cisgender, heterosexual male, and I know I have a lot of privilege going into this conversation. So I'm here to be a co-conspirator, which is a term that you taught me. So thank you for that. And so I really am here to be a co-conspirator for the Black, Indigenous people, and other people of the global majority. So I just want to conduct this interview as, you know, a co-conspirator. So just like you did right there. Please.
Other people of the global majority. Did you hear that, everybody? Did you hear that? I do not use the word minority. It isn't true. The global majority is actually, it's true. If I want everyone to go look up the video, If the World Were 100 People, and you will see, and maybe you'll have links to those in that in the show notes, the most recent one, they kind of do it every year or two. It really is, you know, we can jump right into this. Into some of the topics, because when we talk about Dr. Rudin's work on windows, mirrors, and sliding glass doors, when we see children's books, we don't see that we're not the minority or we're not the majority, or we just see what publishers put out there. And we're really not getting what the world looks like in our books. But I know you have a number of questions, so I will
no good
stop on that. But it's interesting that you say that. I think that term is so lovely. It's a delicious term that you don't hear often.
Yeah. So I'll give a little tip here. My wife's a DEI consultant, and I had her go over these questions because I wanted to get everything right. And so she's the one who said, that's a good term to use. So I was like, fantastic. I will try to use all the right terminology. All right. So yeah. So last summer, the Black Lives Matter uprising, there were a lot of companies that put out statements in support of DEI and against police brutality. But some of the statements kind of felt more performative than actually something that would really push the dial forward. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, like, so what are those types of things that are more performative, and how are they sometimes even damaging to the cause?
The performative things are that they're statements with no teeth, with no other acknowledgement or activity that happens after that. So what I need to see as a CDO, Chief Diversity Officer, Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer, whatever the title is at your organization, is that you have policies and procedures in place that you actually act on. Teeth means that your top executives are their bonuses, their compensation, their performance evaluations are actually tied to real numbers. I'm a numbers geek. I love a number. I love to measure what I treasure and to have results related to that. That means that your marketing, your output, the people and organizations that you consume, from whom you purchase, your purchasing organization needs to be embedded with making sure that things are equitable. I mean, look at the world around us. And let's just take the publishing industry. because we could go on for hours about oil and gas or, you know, government agencies or, you know, any other one. But if we just look at the publishing agency, we have the numbers. We Lee and Lowe puts out really great graphics and articles. If you look at their their blog, they have, you know, what does the publishing industry look like? The, you know, Publishers Weekly just, I think they put out Publishing So White. I think that was the title of the article. Mm-hmm. And until we have working wages for your interns, you're always going to get the wealthy Connecticut set that can afford to have an unpaid internship or a low paid internship. And you're going to continue to see that skill set or that voice or that angle on publishing. And what I think it was 4% of marketing professionals are Black or African American or of African descent. And we don't exist like that in space. And if you want to have a globally successful brand, then we do have to look at what do we look like in this organization? Because the voices missing in the room are the voices that will not be purchasing from you. So advertising, understanding the market share, the marketplace, what books are going to speak to people and how to market those books, right? Like you may have a white channel or a majority channel, because majority in the US is still white, but you may have a majority channel and understand that channel really well. But do you understand Black radio? Do you understand Black churches? Do you understand, you know, and so there are so many other layers to how we market and get the word out. Barbershops, you know, there's a really lovely nonprofit called Books with Barbers where, you know, we distribute books through barbershops. It's part of how we, and I say we because I haven't defined myself yet, but it's one of the ways that we get together and commune and share. It's our water cooler of sorts for our community is hair salons, beauty salons, barbershops, nail salons, et cetera, and churches and a number of other things. No group is a monolith, but also understanding how we connect generally is going to be really important for your organization. And you can say as much as you want, oh, we don't know how. I think for the tagline or the thing that people were saying, for many years, many, many, too many, and I've still heard that it's said somewhere, is that Black people don't buy books, and which basically means Black people don't read, which basically means there's not a market for it. So why are we even leaning in? And I think we've proved that wrong.
Yeah, well, that's so inherently racist. It's like it's offensive that. In fact, I did hear there was this really great. I forget the name of their company. One of our members at IBPA, they did an interview and they were talking about that when they first started out, they heard that phrase and they said, because they were trying to get someone else to publish the book, and they said, you know what, forget it. Oh, Just Us Books, that's their name. They said, you know what, we're going to start our own independent publishing company. And they're incredible. They do really great work, really great books. They're very successful. So like you said, they disproved that ridiculous theory. And I love that they were like, oh yeah, okay. And they like just did it themselves. So,
well, isn't that what independent publishing is, right? Yeah. When we talk about one of the things that we're looking at the SCBWI is, you know, for many years we have these established publishers who are really, they're amazing. They're very good at creating and looking at quality books. And so we look at them as the cream of, you know, established publishers, our PAL membership. But then when we really take a look at it and realize, wait a minute, this industry has historically, categorically denied and disenfranchised huge swaths of people out of having a voice in this industry and forced them to go and publish independently. Or not open the doors or the secrets or the keys to the kingdom, which I think we at the SCBWI do really, really well. I mean, all of our members get something called the book, which teaches you how to either get published or be published or, you know, how to write the craft, how to write and the craft of writing anywhere from a picture book to a YA novel. is in there along with all of our free workshops and our paid workshops as well through every region all over the world. And it's, you know, we take away the mystery for everyone. But getting published and knowing how to do that and not look like you self-published because you don't know that your dummy should be how many pages, Chris? Is it pages? I know that you guys know, like there's a certain number of pages. I just opened an independently published book, which was lovely, but it had like eight white pages in the back, which to me as a parent would confuse me. I'm like, is my kid supposed to draw in this?
That's where you draw pictures, of course. Right?
because they haven't taken courses from IBPA to know what their picture book is supposed to actually look like and how many pages. And if you're going to do this, please do it right. And so, yeah, so we are really looking at, okay, who has been independent, you know, self-published and independently published so that we know where all the voices are coming from, mm-hmm. you know, and I know some really great authors who just said, I'm going to go publish myself. And they've been very successful with their school visits and making those rounds, and they have a great career at it. And some of them eventually do get noticed by publishing. But then again, even the publishing arms, we know that if they don't know how to market us, or don't have the marketing budget, or the marketing budget is reserved for somebody who has already proved themselves, that you still have to figure out a way to get your books out there on your own. So I know that you had stated earlier, I don't want to keep the mystery going for everyone who's watching. I am also cisgendered. And I'm a cisgender straight woman. I happen to be bluish, which means I'm black and Jewish. A lot of people think I'm from everywhere and speak to me in every language, which I have lived in Europe, South America, and the United States. And so I do speak a few languages. I'm bilingual, English, Spanish. And my family represents every single thing you could imagine, from LGBTQ+, neurodivergent, neuroatypical. There's some disability, and all my nieces and nephews are Latinx. So we are what is coming for you. So the fastest growing group of underrepresented people in this country are mixed race kids. Mm. So my grandparents only have one white grandchild. They have zero white great-grandchildren. My mom doesn't have any white grandchildren. And so my message to the world, if I have one, is the world, and especially anywhere where white is the majority, is the likelihood of you having an LGBTQ+, disabled, neuroatypical, and or mixed grandchild is very, very high. And I hope you will make the investment now to make the world a better place for them. Yeah. I would also add to that, you may be super wealthy, but even if you are, there's no guarantee that your grandchildren won't be, you know, have socioeconomic difficulties or be socioeconomically disenfranchised. We've seen it takes three generations to build and one to destroy some of these legacies. So we hope that you'll also create a world where there's social and environmental and socioeconomic justice. I always want to put that out there.
Well, on that note, something that, like, so there's been some movement on, you know, these organizations, publishers, people coming out and saying, hey, we support this, and they're actually making strides. But then, as is always the case, there's some backlash, some people saying, why are you getting political? That's not your job. You know, you're just a book publisher or whatever it is. So I want to see if you can talk about, you know, like about that backlash and why, you know, why it's wrong.
Chris, I send these email messages out probably once a week. We definitely have people who are dissatisfied, have even called us socialists, because we now recognize, not now, we have for some time, but we are putting our money where our mouths are in terms of making things equitable and making sure that our product lines, our offerings reflect what our human family looks like. And we are a human family. And so social justice, racial reckoning, call it what you want, it's not a political thing. It's more of a human thing. We have to be humane in the way that we operate in this space. I would argue that it is way more political to only fight for your own and to only fight for your own piece of the pie and to ensure that your type of people are the only ones that get whatever it is that you want versus trying to make sure that everyone has a seat at the table. And I love, there's some videos that I have pinned to my site. There, it's just, what is the difference between equity and equality? They're very different. I love the visual of three people in a row, a dad with his two children, and they're all trying to see over a fence. And so, you know, they each need different size boxes in order to see over the fence. They're all on the same ground, so they're equal, right? But the equity isn't there for them to actually see the game. And a lot of people start ahead of the game. If you've never been harassed by the police, you're ahead of the game. I have been harassed by the police. I've been thrown against a wall, like literally doing, probably mouthing off for a teenager, but they had drawn a gun on me. So I was absolutely terrified because we were Black in Beverly Hills. That was one of my, I still think about the multiple times I've been harassed by police, and that's in the back of my brain. So when you think about microaggressions and micro inequities, those build on a person. It's like death by a thousand cuts. And if we're not paying attention to the impact that can have on a people, on a group, on a race, on an entire, on generations, then you are very fortunate because you don't have to think that way. But it's not political. It's equitable. And we have to look at how people have been treated for centuries of poor treatment and murder. Like, I don't know a Black man in my life who hasn't been stopped multiple times a year driving. So what does that do? Like, when was the last time you got pulled over, Chris?
Honestly, I can't even remember. That's how long ago it was. Yeah.
Right. But when you do get pulled over, what does it do to your body?
I mean, scared. Absolutely.
Do you get the hot sweats under your armpits and like, you know?
Yeah, because like I know I'm innocent, but then there's that immediately feeling you're like, what's going to happen? I'm innocent, but they're going to find something that I did, you know? So yeah, I mean, it's just terrifying. Yeah.
So that sends cortisol through your body. If you think about how people just, if that happens multiple times, happens to your family members and all of those things, it's just no wonder our health is impacted as a Black group within the United States of America. So we could go down every nook and cranny about inequities and inequality, but there's no reason for us not to have the ERA, the, you know, equal rights for women. That it just, none of it makes sense to me. And I don't think it's a political thing. It's been politicized, but it's really a human message. Are we all equal? Are we really? Do you really want the best for your neighbor, your friends, your children, your future grandchildren? And how do we go about doing that? How do we give everyone a fair and equitable shot at what most of us want is just shelter, food, housing, a life that we can be proud of, and our health.
Hello, everyone. As promised, I'm about to reveal the IBPA Publishing University discount code. All right, so you're going to go to publishinguniversity.org, and during checkout, you're going to put in this promo code, IBPA podcast. Again, it's all one word, it's lowercase, and it's IBPA podcast. We cannot wait to see you at this year's virtual conference, which is April 7th through 10th, 2021. See you there, everyone. With that, the good thing is I do see some organizations, publishers out there who are saying, okay, I want to try to make a difference, a change in my organization. So they're hiring then DEI consultants. And I wanted to see if you have any tips for people, one, where to find a good one, but then also find a match for where they are in terms of their educational needs. So let's say like the company they're like at the very beginning stages and they need like just a general education about, you know, how like oppression manifests in the publishing world. But then there are other ones where they're looking for like the people that work there are looking for introspection, maybe a place to emote about racial challenges in their organization. So those are different things that they would need to find. So I just want to see if you have any tips to help people.
Absolutely. In addition to the SCBWI, I do consulting through my consulting practice, First Impression RX, but I can't be everywhere at every time. And what I love LinkedIn for this, because I think if you put it out there, we are in the beginning stages. Like, there's no reason not to be transparent. In this journey of equity and inclusion, transparency is a value that I admire so much in organizations that tell their staff, we value this, we don't know how to do it yet, and we're going to get some help. And so putting it out there and just saying, we are on this stage of our journey, we would love some recommendations from you, our audience, anybody following us, and see what you come up with. And you can interview those people, ask for references, see who they've worked with. I think if there are organizations that you admire the work they're doing, sometimes it's with a chief equity and inclusion officer, and sometimes it's with an entire team that has been outsourced. So looking at that, I think more organizations are being transparent about that. And you'll find some great responses. The other thing, there are groups on LinkedIn as well for equity and inclusion professionals. So it might work to lob a post there to the manager there and ask them to repost your request.
And along those same lines, okay, so an indie publisher wants to hire employees that represent more marginalized backgrounds. So how do they go about the hiring process to do that?
I think it's really important. Two things are really important. The language that you put in your job descriptions, I think it is perfectly okay. And I'm not an attorney, I'm not an HR professional, and I'm not in your region or state. But I think it is okay, and you'll have to check with your HR professional / attorney. We are looking for diverse voices in this role. We are specifically looking for disabled, neuroatypical, BIPOC, which stands for, in the UK it would be BAME, in the US it's BIPOC, but Black Indigenous People of Color, for this role. And you make sure you look at the language, right? Like, one of the things we've noticed overall is that women won't apply for things unless we meet like 90% or 98% of the bullet points. Mm. And men will tend to apply, people who identify as men tend to apply for things that where they meet maybe 60% of the bullet points and they're like, I got this. And it's just a different way that we look at ourselves and the world and how we're accepted. And I think that's reflected in leadership, right? In leadership in our companies all across the world. So making sure that your language is really pointed. There are great organizations that will look at the language of your job posts. But I also recommend making sure that people who are interviewing, I don't care who you have to get, but your table should not just be middle-aged white men to interview people when you want, different looking people and different voices to come to the table. You should have a variety of people in that interview space, because that also brings some comfort. You know, I remember when I interviewed for the SCBWI, we were all in Zooms. I still have not met the whole team in person, by the way. Mm-hmm. I joined, I think, June 3rd, right as the whole, everything was going on with post George Floyd and the racial reckoning and the social justice movement was happening in this past summer 2020, for those of you who are looking at this years from now. Mm-hmm. And the first face I saw was a Black woman. I hadn't thought of it before, because I wasn't really interviewing, But I really, it's folded into my story because I felt myself immediately just calm down a bit and just say, okay, she sees me. I know she sees me. And I see her. And so that's important. And well, what if you say, well, we don't have any BIPOC people. We don't have any disabled people in my organization. That's fine. You have to start somewhere. Like, no excuses, really. There is no excuse for you not to have people that don't look like you at your organization. Mm-hmm. And you, if you want to be successful, you must do this. I think some of the best stories we've heard about this is just like, look at the success of Black Panther, all Black cast, written by, you know, and Black directors, you know, most of the people who worked on that were of African descent. And it was such a successful story. Wonder Woman, same thing, woman director, woman cast, women produced, and women driven. And it was also very, very, the original Wonder Woman, not 1984, but it was also very successful. And we see this happen over and over again. And people wonder, you know, where they've been, where, how did they miss this information? And we've always known people who are considered underrepresented here in the U.S. spend per capita a lot more than people whom we consider the majority. So we're missing out on, we're missing the mark and missing the opportunities most often to make sure that we're capturing the marketplace.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because every time there's like articles that say, well, look at that. If you, this film that had most like, what was the one that had the Crazy Rich Asians, right? Where it was like, they're like, wow, how was that a success? And you're like, why is this a surprise? It's just a good movie. Like, why are people like, as if because it has most like all Asian casts and all that, that like, it's not going to be good or something, you know, you're like, just,
it's like, and, but here's the thing, even if it weren't good, Asians make up 60% of the world's population or more.
Yeah.
Why would you not crack that nut? Like, why, just because they're a minority here in the United States, globally, they are the vast majority. I mean, depending on how you break it down. So that's a huge, huge opportunity.
Yeah.
If we're talking dollars and cents, there's a huge opportunity there.
We could go on about all that stuff. This is something that I think is a really interesting topic. We talked about own voices, and I wanted, first, I want you to kind of define that phrase, but in this question, which is, there was a big news story with the book American Dirt, and it's about Mexican immigration, but it was written by a woman who's white and not an immigrant. So I thought, what can any publishers learn from that whole like story, that whole the whole scandal that broke out, and then explain what Own Voices is?
Okay, I think there's a lot, so much to unpack here. I don't even know if there's time in your podcast, but I'm going to try. I'm a long talker, so feel free to edit me as much as you want. Let's start with the definition of Own Voices and lived experience. Own Voices, and I'm forgetting her name, forgive me, but maybe while I'm talking, you can look it up. Own Voices is an expression that was coined recently in the last several years to mean that underrepresented voices, an underrepresented person wrote about their same community. Let me explain what I mean by that. If I am a disabled author and I am writing, and I the centering character, the main character, is also disabled, I am the right person or appropriate person to tell that story. Or I'm just saying, this is an Own Voices situation. As a Black person, I am writing primarily about Black characters in my work or Black history in my work. That is an Own Voices situation. Why? Because I've been brought up with the rhythms, the food, the smells, the taste, the touch of Black society and my whole life. So it may, and nicknames even, you know, when I think about The Hate U Give another recent book that I read, two of the main characters have the same nickname, Munch. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear Munch as a nickname in a lot of, because you eat a lot, it's like you're a snacker. You don't hear that nickname in other types of books. I certainly haven't. I'm also Jewish, right? And I heard a story where the publisher wanted somebody who wasn't Jewish to do the artwork. And for Shabbat, which is the Sabbath, they put three Kiddush cups out on the table. And the author said, well, why did you put three Kiddush cups out? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, there's the mother, the daughter, and the father. There's mm-hmm. three Kiddush cups, right? There's one main Kiddush cup, and sometimes you have like little ancillary cups, but generally sometimes you'll have a couple for, you know, if we're waiting for Elijah or something, and maybe and maybe somebody else. But generally you do want to know the culture intimately before even beginning to tackle that. And I don't want people to think, all right, I'm not putting any more Black characters in my book, no Asians, no disabled, like I'm just not mm-hmm. doing it. And that is not what I'm asking. Mm. We have to keep books to include everyone. The world has to reflect the world for our children. I am absolutely not saying that, but I am saying, please do all the things to get it right. If you're an illustrator and don't know how to draw Asian faces, look to what Asian books are doing in Asia, right? Do some of that research. When we talk about lived experience is another angle. I have lived in South America. I have lived in Europe. I have a lived experience that is different from what a Black Jewish woman in the United States may have lived. So I have this other part of me that speaks a lot of Spanish, you know, on a very regular basis. I, you know, have invested, my family's Latinx. Does that mean I should tell a Latinx story? I don't know, but I will say that I also know people a middle-aged, middle-class white man who was born and raised in Japan. Mm. Is what story is he supposed to tell? I don't know. I don't have the answer. I'm not here to give permission, but there is something to the lived experience as well. And I don't want to take that away from anyone. Kwame Alexander said, who are you inviting to your kitchen table? Right? Like, if you don't have Black friends, or now's not the time to go get one, we're not like accessory items, but for your children, make that effort. You've got to try to go outside the bubble, and make those connections. And if you don't have a Black friend in 2020, or an Asian friend, or an Indian friend, or a disabled friend, what's going on? You know, you have to ask that question and do the extra research. So that being said, the controversy is, over time, white people or majority people have made money off of stories that center other types of people. Mm. And the movement is that they're saying, you know what? I may not be the right person to tell this story. I found this really great research string, and I'm going to give it to a Black writer. I'm going to give it to a Latinx writer. I'm going to give it to a Hispanic writer, so that they can bring some nuanced and lived experience own voices to that story. And I think over time, the richness that is going to come from that is going to be phenomenal. You will get insight that you would not have otherwise. One of the other own voices issues that comes up is own voices around disability. So, and I'm not here to disparage anyone who's written a book that centers a disabled character, but when you see the difference between El Defo, and I'm not going to disparage anyone, but maybe a book written by a mom, El Defo is written by own voices, and someone who's maybe a mother who at the end, you know, your legs start working and everybody loves you and, it's all great. Like, there are differences in how someone who's living with a disability will view things versus somebody who has experienced it, you know, as a parent or an outsider. And so I think this is a socioeconomic justice issue. Why would you purchase a book or promote a book only by white authors and not try to get that story from an own voices author?
Well, I can't tell you how much I think that's such an important thing. I'm so glad that I got to that because, crazy enough, we're kind of almost running out of time. So I have two more questions I want to ask you. First off, you're new to SCBWI, so I just want to see what you're excited about coming up in 2021.
Well, I'm so excited about so many things. This could take up all the rest of the time. One, we are a global organization. So to me, I feel, and like, this is the big secret, right? I think we're all missing out on books from all over the world, those Batch Elder Awards, those translated works, Spanish language. So we are really, we're doing a lot more with our Spanish language. We're starting with our largest, you know, our second largest language other than English. And I do want to give you that vocabulary word, LOTE, L-O-T-E, language other than English. Instead of, sometimes I'm so used to LOTE that I don't even remember what people say for ESL, right? English as a second language, or, you know, it's that centers English, right? But LOTE, languages other than English, is its own category as well. So making sure that we're looking at and creating space for our translator members is a passion of mine. Making sure that we have resources for our Spanish speaking members as well. Opening spaces. We have done a really good job even before I arrived at making sure that we had a really diverse group that represented us in our boards, in our committees, in our teams. I think we can do a better job of that, certainly regionally. So we are expanding our equity and inclusion teams to regions all over the world. We're doing our own in-house training so that all of our volunteers and staff have access to equity and inclusion training and what that means for us as an organization. Our policies and procedures have been realigned and they've been always been very, very good. But we also recognize if we don't look at equity and inclusion as an important value, and if that's not important to you, and if you don't see the world in that way, we get it. But if you're homophobic or racist or ableist or ageist or, you know, misogynist, we're probably not the right organization for you. And we're okay, and we're saying that. The other thing that we're doing is we are hosting and sponsoring something we haven't fully named yet, because originally we liked the CLIC, which was the Children's Literary Inclusion Committee or Consortium or Council, but then we realized that acronym just so poorly reflected on the industry. It is so cliquish. Oh. And so we didn't want to use it. So if anybody has anything snappy, an idea around that, we're drawing in people, organizations that care about children's literature so that we can go to the publishers and say, hey, you know, we've looked at all of this, like Lee and Lowe, the CBC, some representatives from each of those groups are trying to, the IBPA is also, will have a seat at this table to say, okay, where are we missing the mark? Where are we looking at these numbers and how are we doing and what can we as a voice do? But at the SCBWI, for us, we are creating workshops and free programs to make sure that people who, and scholarships, we have a number of scholarships and grants in every single region of the world to make, and some of them are dedicated to people who may not have been reached previously. Our very first Giving Tuesday, we dedicated to disabled creators of children's literature. We are giving 100% of that money to people who identify as disabled. We're redoing all of our identifiers so that you can find Own Voices people in our membership. So we're redoing the entire member profile page so that people can say, you know, I'm LGBTQ+. I am I have neurodivergence or neuroatypicality, and you know, all of those things, so that publishers and editors and authors and can find Own Voices and lived experience a lot easier. And I want to say one more thing about language, because it is important. When I read, there's a book called They Were Her Slaves. They Were Her Property. Excuse me. They Were Her Property. And I read the words enslaved people and enslavers. And I thought that was so powerful, because hearing slave master, it kind of gives you that master, right? Mm-hmm. That it just was like, it's different to use the word enslaver and enslaved people. Like, it wasn't a choice, right? Versus slaves. I think language is really important, and I hope that we are taking strides, not only at the SCBWI, but elsewhere, to talk about the language that we use in children's books, about Black joy, about making sure that we're not just talking about sad stories about Black kids during the shortest month of the year. There's a great movement, I think it's by the Brown Bookshelf, called hashtag 28 Days Later. Like, why are we not talking about Black joy and just regular, you know, Black fantasy? Or, you know, I'm using Black as an example, but any type of underrepresented work, every day, in every way.
Yeah, and I agree. The language is something that we've been, you know, indoctrinated since we were little kids, using certain words for like our, you know, describing all this stuff. And at some point you go, wait a second, like, that's actually an offensive term, and you have to unlearn it. You have to, like, actively stop saying those things. And I think there are some people who fight against that, but then there are people who they're trying, but then it keeps slipping. So I think it's just important to, at every turn, continue to, like, right, that's the wrong use. That term is offensive to you. So I need to stop using that term. So,
and I'm not going to cancel you because of that, Chris. One of the other things that I'm passionate about is that we're going to keep making mistakes. We're going to have missteps. This is where I live. I've been doing this work for many, many years, and I'm still learning. And I've been called out, like, and canceled. You know, the people have called me out for not being woke enough. And I was listening to Michelle Obama the other day, and she said, and I'm paraphrasing, and she said, "You can be woke, but your job is to wake up others." Mm. and not to, you know, tone police or anything. She didn't say that, but if you're just about canceling people, including people that are on your side, what are you doing? Mm. You are going to have people running from you instead of embracing you and embracing that idea. Like, I don't want somebody to stop drawing Black kids in books or putting Asian kids in books because they made one mistake. There are people who won't even touch putting a Native American story in their books for fear of being called out, you know, by people for doing it wrong. And yes, you should be wary. You should definitely do the research. But I don't want to erase children from children's books.
Yeah.
For fear of being canceled.
Thank you. Yeah. So we're pretty much out of time, but I do want to mention you're going to be a speaker, not only a speaker at IBPA Publishing University, you're going to be a keynote speaker. So we're very excited and privileged to have you coming. And that's going to be on April 9th. And so during the episode, you heard the ad for the discount. So I'll just say it here. It's IBPA podcast, all one word, lowercase, IBPA podcast. So you get 15% off. So make sure that you go and register for the conference. We'd love to have you. And you can see April, especially if you enjoyed this episode, you'll get to see all kinds of more really great information.
Some of it will be repeated. I can't help myself.
No.
It's like a sneak peek.
Yeah, right. This was a little taste of the magic coming. And I also want to thank IBPA for being a sponsor. I am grateful to work at this organization. We also have the DEI task force, where we felt it was very important to, like, we were talking about the statements. We're like, no, we're not just putting out a statement. We're going to change our organization. So we have a whole task force that's creating a strategic plan. So we're excited, and we're slowly but surely implementing that whole plan throughout the year. And make sure to visit IBPA-online.org to learn more about IBPA, and subscribe to this podcast, because I love having people listen to it. And it's going to drop the last Thursday of every month. So April, I cannot tell you again, thank you so much. This has been so informative for me, and I hope our listeners have been informed as well.
It was my pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to seeing everyone at the IBPA conference and beyond. Great information, especially if you are looking to self-publish. Please don't miss it.
All right. Thank you, everyone.